I want to introduce myself. My name's Adam Feldman. I'm one of the librarians here. I'm actually the kind of the coordinator of educational programming here at the Free Library, at this branch, at the Central Library. But in some ways, this isn't just one library. It's a dozen or more special collections, special libraries within these walls. And one of them is the Regional Foundation Center. Can I ask, has anyone been to the Regional Foundation Center? Can I see your hands? A good number of you. Who here works for a social service agency or an arts organization or a nonprofit of almost any type? All of you need to become better acquainted with the Regional Foundation Center. It's really like a real hidden gem of this library system. And in some ways, it's the midwife of tonight's program and the event series that we're having here today. The Regional Foundation Center serves nonprofits. It has the kind of databases and resources necessary to do serious research, to build your nonprofits, to figure out fundraising campaigns, to otherwise deal with the discourse in nonprofit management and development. And we know that our partners in LQD and Juvenile Law Center were users of it, and I think some of the conversations that led to this whole series were really born in that space. So I want to invite all of you who may not have been there to come and bring more of these conversations out so we can bring more to life. I'd like to invite to the stage Jessica Fireman, who is the Associate Director of the Juvenile Law Center. Jessica, would you come to the stage and kick off tonight's program for us?
Thank you, and thank you so much to the Free Library for hosting us. And I also want to thank the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which has been supporting our work on solitary confinement. And welcome to you all. Being in isolation, to me, felt like I was on an island all alone, dying a slow death from the inside out. These are the words of a young man in California who was talking about his experience in solitary confinement. For those of us who are lawyers working on this issue, we hear from our clients about their experiences, and it's our challenge to talk to policymakers, to courts, to our friends and family, to our community, to try to communicate what we've heard, and it's really a struggle. We struggle with the task of conveying the physical, the mental, the emotional consequences of solitary confinement. So today we're incredibly grateful to be joined by many people collaborating together to paint a fuller picture of the problem and to start a really vital conversation about solutions. LQD has partnered with us to bring this exhibit and panel together, leading the way in connecting visual arts and social change. As I think many of you probably saw upstairs, Richard Ross says more in one photograph than we can say in 10 legal briefs. Our panelists, who you'll meet in a moment, come at the issue from four different perspectives. They're sharing personal, legal, psychological, and artistic insights. We want to start our evening with a video, which also features Richard Ross's photographs. The video not only identifies a problem, but also highlights the voices of juvenile justice administrators already working to make a change. We're really excited to be working on this issue at a moment when we see things starting to change. So let's start the video.
Imagine yourself as a teenager, spending days, weeks, or months in a room so small, you could touch the walls with both hands. Imagine having nothing constructive to help pass the time. No one to talk to. No paper and pen, books, photos, or cell phone. You're left alone with your thoughts. You stare at the door. You become anxious, jittery. You might start talking out loud to yourself. Eventually, you may start believing you see things that aren't there. You scream at the people who put you there, even if they can't hear you. You don't become remorseful or contrite. You become more angry. This is what thousands of young people housed in U.S. juvenile and adult facilities experience each year. Research shows that solitary confinement for longer than a cooling off period is not an effective tool for reducing behavioral incidents or improving the safety of facilities. Nowhere is the damaging impact of incarceration on vulnerable children more obvious than when it comes to solitary confinement. Solitary confinement can lead to long-lasting and devastating effects on youth, including trauma, psychosis, depression, anxiety, and increased risk of suicide and self-harm. And even more devastating, more than 50% of all youth suicides in juvenile facilities occur while young people are isolated in solitary. Many organizations have researched and advocated for a change in policy and practice of solitary confinement, including children's advocacy organizations, medical and mental health associations, and organizations for administrators of juvenile detention facilities. We must do better for our kids in detention by giving them the chance to grow and succeed in life. We must address rehabilitation of the whole person by offering more education, mental health services, and drug treatment. A kid alone in a room does not have the chance to increase his or her skill set. We reduce solitary confinement by 89%, and at the same time, violence decreased by 22%. Instead of putting youth in solitary, we must offer alternative programs. In addition to mental health counseling, we started a family engagement program. We changed the visiting hours so youth could see their family members, and family could also participate in meetings. A sea change is happening. The results show that alternatives can work. And on January 25th, 2016, President Obama prohibited the use of solitary confinement for youth in federal custody. Change within the state and local level must start today, with you. We have a moral responsibility to our youth to stop solitary for kids.
And, a real thanks goes to the many people who helped work on this video, including our friends at the advertising agency M, who volunteered their time to put that together. And the problem of solitary confinement is really best understood in context. And this evening, this exhibit of the cell and the photographs and this panel presentation are part of a larger effort that's happening across Philadelphia right now. Right now at Eastern State Penitentiary, there's an exhibit placing the problem of juvenile solitary confinement within the broader context of mass incarceration and the history of mass incarceration. And right now at the African American Museum is shedding light on racial disparities in the criminal justice system that's also linked to the problem of solitary confinement. So both of these exhibits really challenge us to think about what do we need to do to change the juvenile justice system and the criminal justice system to bring young people back home into their families and communities. At this point, it's my honor to introduce our moderator, Solomon Jones. Many of you will know his voice from WURD Radio and know that he's an award-winning columnist, a national voice on marriage and fatherhood, and a local inspiration on literacy, on ending homelessness, and numerous other social justice issues. We're incredibly grateful that he's lending his voice to this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, for that powerful video, and for a great start to this event this evening. I am Solomon Jones. I'm a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and a morning host on 900 AM WURD Radio. And it is my pleasure to join you this evening for this event. Before I introduce our panelists, I just want to call your attention to the fact that each of you have been given a little card. And if you're like me, you got a little pencil too. They're really cute. So if you have a question, you can write that question down. We will collect and ask our panelists select questions from you during the audience Q&A section of tonight's event. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists for Juvenile Injustice and Solitary Confinement. Of course, this is a panel discussion around this very important issue that has caught the attention of the White House as well as advocates around the country. And you'll see how important I am by the fact that my name tag just fell on the floor. Johnny Perez is our first panelist. He is a non-attorney advocate at the Urban Justice Center Mental Health Project, a civil services law firm, a civil services firm that provides legal and social work services to people with serious mental illness. He's assigned to MHP's Safe Reentry Project, where he assists people with mental illness and histories of incarceration. Please give him a hand. And Naomi Goldstein, PhD, is professor of psychology at Drexel University, co-director of Drexel's JD PhD program in law and psychology. Goldstein, director of the Juvenile Justice Research and Reform Lab at Drexel, seeks to improve juvenile justice policy and practice across the country. Please give her a hand. And Richard Ross is not the police commissioner. But he is a photographer, researcher, and professor of art based in Santa Barbara, California. Ross has been the recipient of grants from the National Endowment of the Arts and was awarded both Fulbright and Guggenheim fellowships. His most recent work, the Injustice Series, turns a lens on the placement and treatment of incarcerated American juveniles. Please come up, Mr. Ross. You can give him a hand. And finally, Marcia Levick is Deputy Director and Chief Counsel of the Juvenile Law Center, which she co-founded in 1975. She has successfully litigated on behalf of children in both the juvenile justice and child welfare systems and spearheaded Juvenile Law Center's litigation arising out of the Luzerne County, Pennsylvania Juvenile Court Judges Corruption Scandal known as Kids for Cash. Please come on up and give her a hand as well. So we're going to get right into our discussion, and since the discussion is centered on the powerful exhibit that many of you have seen by Richard Ross, our first question will be for Richard. images have played roles in movements throughout history, but particularly in the civil rights movement, which used televised images of brutality to move public opinion. And in the current movement concerning police violence, which has made use of cell phone video and other images, Richard, how do you hope your use of photography will shape the conversation around juvenile solitary confinement?
First, thank you for having me, and forgive me for being so underdressed compared to everybody else. We just got out of prison at Greaterford. I went there with my wife for about 4 hours interviewing Joseph Lingen, who's been incarcerated for 63 years, 5 months and 1 day, for a crime he did after a one-day trial. The images, it comes from a tradition of Jacob Riis, Lewis Hine, Gordon Parks, Danny Lyon, Charles Moore. The whole idea is to witness. The whole idea is to the world of institutions and brutality can be really harsh if it is obscured. And my goal, specifically with these images, is to make people understand that organizations like Marsha's, like the NEKC, are great in terms of data and in terms of policy. And my goal is to make sure that people know that there are lives at stake and to understand the size of the people that you're dealing with. So an image shows you what a 9-year-old, a 10-year-old, an 11-year-old actually is when they're in solitary.
So I want to follow up that question and just ask this one regarding how those photographs are distributed. Because it's great to have them here, but one of the things that has really multiplied the effect of images now is the internet. So what role does technology play in you sharing these images that you want to use to shape this discussion?
Basically, the work is punishing, to use a bad verb, but doing the work is difficult. And my goal in doing this is to make organizations like the Juvenile Law Center, make them available to them at a really nominal cost. So just get the images out there. Normally, an artist likes to have fine art matted, framed, created, and exhibited at museums. My goal is to have it impact legislation. So I basically have decommodified it. And they go up with pushpins, they go up with bulldog clips. I don't care, as long as they get out there and part of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it's interesting that you talked about Graterford, because that kind of segues into my next question. Where solitary confinement is concerned, Philadelphia was really on the leading edge of the use of solitary confinement with Eastern State Penitentiary, which was completed in 1829. And it was known not just for the architecture there, which was copied in prisons around the world, but also for that use of solitary confinement. Charles Dickens visited in 1842, and this is what he said. He said, "The designers do not know what it is that they are doing. I hold this slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body." Naomi, was Charles Dickens right when he said that? And if so, how does the psychology of solitary confinement actually work?
Sure. So I think there's really two issues when you're thinking about solitary confinement. So one is the issue of imposing negative, really, really, really negative experiences on a child or an adult, right? So this is a situation that is anxiety-inducing. I mean, how many of you walked into the clear cell downstairs or upstairs? I mean, I was in there too. It was fairly horrifying, even being in there with other people, there not being a door, being able to see through it. Imagine being a child who walks in there and the door is shut, and that's petrifying, not knowing when you're going to get out. You're a child. As a child, it's very hard to imagine the future. Everything is in the moment. And so this inducement of what for many people is a very traumatic experience, and the symptoms of anxiety and depression and hopelessness and fear that come out of it are really quite terrible and can have both short and long-term impacts. The other piece of it that I think people don't talk about as much is the absence of the positive experiences, and that's critically important. And we can certainly talk a little later about some of the developmental issues that are associated with this, but you're depriving kids of normal experiences, normal social interactions, normal stimulation, normal education, normal physical experiences, and it's those two things combined that can really contribute to both long-term, short-term issues where we certainly see increased rates of suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, and then long-term capacities in a variety of ways, mental health related, educationally related, cognitive functioning. Hmm.
You know, it's interesting to me that Eastern State now has this exhibit around mass incarceration. We often hear the number 2.3 million in terms of the number of people we have incarcerated here in the United States. I wonder if Eastern State stopped using this with grown men when they had that model, how do we get to the point where we were using it with children?
That is a very good question. You know, I think solitary confinement and isolation come under lots of different names. Some are as a form of consequences. Some are as a form of protection. Some are considered to be safety for self, safety for others. And I think, what it's doing to people is really an important question. And I think we've certainly seen many negative consequences in lots of different types of situations with many types of uses.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And one of the most famous cases was that of Kalief Browder. He was a young man who was sent to Rikers Island when he was 16, accused of stealing a backpack. He never stood trial. He was never found guilty of any crime, but he stayed at Rikers Island for 3 years, nearly two of those years in solitary confinement. There was activism around it. He was finally released. When he was released, he went home to his parents' home, and he committed suicide. Like Kalief Browder, Johnny Perez, you spent some time in solitary confinement as a teen. How did your story and experience compare to his?
Yeah, first I'd like to say thank you for having me. It's really important that when we talk about these issues, we involve the voice of the people that are directly affected by the issue. So I'm very honored to be here. And when I think about Kalief, I also want to add that he also had multiple suicide attempts during his stay there, and it went completely ignored by correctional staff of a number of different levels. And then, unfortunately, 6 months after he came home, he succeeded. When I think about my own experience, 16 years old on Rikers Island, if you don't know anything about Rikers Island, if you've ever seen the inside of Rikers Island, you'll know that architecturally is a very depressing space. You know, the colors make you sad. You know, hospital grays, you know, things of that nature. And 16 years old, arrested for gun possession, I go to Rikers Island for the first time. And as I'm waiting for the housing unit to be placed in the housing unit, the correctional officer says, Johnny Perez, you're going to the butcher shop. I'm at the butcher shop. I didn't know they had beds inside the kitchen here. Right? And he's like, no, actually, the butcher shop is a housing unit. It's two upper. And the reason that we call it the butcher shop is because that's where most of our cuttings happen. And 16 years old, I'm thinking, I mean, now in hindsight as an adult, I don't know what bothered me more about that statement. Was it the fact that it was called the butcher shop or the fact that it was coming from a correction officer who's also supposed to protect me from the butcher shop and all the things that happened there? Once I arrived there, If you don't know anything about juveniles in this space, specifically Rikers Island, there are a lot of gangs in Rikers Island, you know, and even groups who may not be labeled as gangs kind of behave like gangs in order for a number of different reasons, mainly protecting themselves, finding solace and love inside these spaces, affirmation in these spaces. And I didn't belong to a gang. As a result of that, there were certain quote-unquote privileges that were not afforded to me, you know, whether it was a certain mattress or using a certain toilet bowl or even using the phone. In my case, I wanted to use the phone to call my lawyer, and this gentleman, who's a lot bigger and taller and stronger than me, said, you can't use the phone. This is a blood phone. And I said, I just want to talk to my mother and find out, you know. And he pushed me, and I turned around, hit him with the phone, and we were both sentenced to 60 days in solitary. During the hearing, the hearing officer did not care, even, you know, he said, you got into a fight, you should know better, you should handle your problems a whole lot differently. Except that he doesn't know that in jail, you don't turn to correction officers about problems, because that in itself creates more problems, you know. Once I arrived in solitary, just my luck has it that the person who was giving out the food, who was also a detainee, belonged to the same gang of the person that I fought, and he worked breakfast and lunch. So for the first 2 weeks of those 60 days, I didn't eat breakfast or lunch. I only ate dinner. And dinner was at 4 o'clock, with breakfast being about 7 o'clock in the morning. You have to be standing up, fully dressed at the door. During that time, I think about, you know, I'm hearing Dr. Goldstein describe some of the psychological ramifications of it. And I remember, you know, feeling a great sense of hopelessness, feeling very alone. I remember counting the bricks on the wall. I remember being so hot that the walls start to sweat in a lot of different cases. You know, it gets real quiet a lot of times, so quiet that you can hear your own heartbeat. And other times it gets so loud from the sound of people screaming, yelling, singing, rapping, even just talking out loud to hear another human voice, that it gets really loud to the point you can't go to sleep. And if you try to put your head underneath the covers, you get woken up every hour on the hour, because prison policy and procedure says that they have to see skin when they walk by. I remember feeling very angry, very distrustful of authority, you know. And then I probably couldn't spell dehumanized then, but I'll label it as very dehumanizing now in a sense that the only person after this gentleman, hopefully he went home after those 2 weeks, but the correction officer who did walk by never even acknowledged my existence. So what I mean by that, I never said hi, I never said, hey, how you doing? You know, how's it going today? Anything like that. Things that we kind of take for granted on a day-to-day basis, but when it doesn't happen over a prolonged period of time, it really does something. And after a while, I started to think, well, maybe I am just a criminal. Maybe I am meant to be here. And I couldn't understand why I had done so bad that not only placed me in this space for what felt like forever, but also, you know, going to the visit to see my mother handcuffed. And, you know, why is it so, what I did that was so bad that I was not worthy of or being denied my human right to hug the person who pushed me into existence, in a sense, you know, and a lot of times I really couldn't make sense of that. I had to fight for commissary phone, my humanity, my dignity, a lot of different ways. And when I think about Khalif and the parallels, is that we were both teenagers inside this same space, and the same people who were supposed to and had sworn to protect us were also either doing the victimizing or facilitating the victimizing. And as a result of that, you know, we have different ramifications. No one ever gets out of solitary. You survive solitary. And, you know, sometimes, and I end with this, sometimes people say, oh, but Johnny, you're so eloquent and, you know, you have a nice haircut. You know, if you're impressed with anything that I say tonight with me as an individual and you think, well, solitary can't be that bad, know that I'm just an example of what happens when we invest in people and not prisons, A. Two, right? When you see grass, you know, you're walking down the street, you see grass growing through a piece of concrete, you don't say, wow, look at that concrete, it made the grass grow. You say, no, the grass grew despite the concrete. So I'm who I am today despite those experiences. Mm-hmm. Thanks for letting me share.
Okay. All right.
So my next question is for Marsha Levitt. And it's about the president's involvement in this. President Obama, in January, I believe, banned the use of solitary confinement for juveniles in federal prisons, citing some of the research that Dr. Goldstein talked about a little bit earlier. He says that the research found that the practice leads to withdrawal, alienation, and the possible worsening of existing mental illnesses. Given that the president banned the use of juvenile solitary confinement in federal institutions, how many state and county institutions followed suit with that ban?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And let me thank all of you in the audience for being here this evening. I think both having Richard Ross here as the recorder of what goes on inside these facilities and having Johnny to share with us his story, a very personal memoir in a bizarre way of what that experience is really, it's rare to have this exposure to see what is going on inside these facilities. I hope that all of you at the end of this program go and stand in the representation cell that has been built upstairs, because you can see out through that plastic, but even with that capacity, it is chilling to be inside there, and it is a frightening example of what it might feel like if, in fact, you were in that cell. I think that President Obama's executive order, which he signed in January of 2016, banning solitary confinement in federal facilities, was a really important example of federal leadership. And we need federal leadership at this point in time as we are engaged, really, and I think the Eastern State exhibit that is looking at a broader question of mass incarceration is engaging all of us in this national conversation about criminal justice reform. And solitary confinement is a piece of that conversation. The limitations of justice of President Obama's executive order is that within the federal system, there are less than 30 kids who will benefit from that ban. Wow. The good news is there aren't a lot of children who are incarcerated in our federal correctional facilities,
but the unfortunate consequence is that we have a very limited reach of what President Obama did through that leadership. There is leadership that we can see in the congressional, at the congressional level. Senator Cory Booker and Rand Paul have introduced bipartisan legislation to similarly ban solitary confinement in ways that would reach into the state systems, but of course that legislation is not moving through Congress. At the state level, we remain a country that tolerates the solitary confinement of both children and of adults. At this point, we have about 20 states, and, you know, as Solomon was looking sort of for specific information, about 20 states that have banned solitary confinement of children. But those bans take different forms. So it may be that a particular state might ban the use of solitary confinement limited to a period of days or a period of weeks. It may limit it to a period of hours. But the challenge that I think we face as a community, as engaged citizens who are concerned about these kinds of issues, is again that if you go and stand in that cell upstairs and you imagine a child, imagine your child, your sibling, your niece, your nephew, who is placed in that very small confined space with nothing in it, with a concrete slab to sleep on, with a thin mattress, maybe, with bed sheets, maybe, with personal belongings, maybe, or not, maybe nothing at all, no reading materials, no other kinds of stimulation whatsoever, no opportunities for peer interaction. Even a few hours of that kind of unbelievably inhumane confinement of an individual can create the kind of trauma and damage that Naomi has described as an expert, that Johnny has described in terms of what he himself experienced. So we are seeing ways in which we are chipping away at what is a pervasive practice in this country, but there is much work to be done, certainly, going forward.
I have to ask this question. Of the 20 states that have banned the use of solitary confinement for juveniles in some form, is Pennsylvania one of them?
Well, so that's an important question, obviously, for those of us sitting here tonight. Pennsylvania, on paper, actually about 35 years ago, as a consequence of litigation that Juvenile Law Center was involved in, appears to have a very progressive stance on the solitary confinement of children. We apparently prohibit the use of solitary for a period longer than 4 hours. I use these terms apparently because the reality is what happens so often in correctional systems is that we see even good policies being breached in the application. And so in Pennsylvania, we have a provision that defines solitary confinement as the placement of children in solitary cells without any interaction or opportunity to have this peer or staff engagement. So what we know goes on sometimes still in facilities in Pennsylvania is a child might be placed in a cell and there might be a staff person placed outside the door of that cell. The facility doesn't think of it as solitary confinement, and so it goes on and can go on for days at a time, well in excess of what is on paper a very progressive time limit of 4 hours. So yes and no, we have the tools, we have the structure in place to do it well, but we find that we nevertheless can breach that at times.
All right. That's important to know. I'm going to go back to Richard Ross, because we've seen these amazing pictures. We've seen how they speak to us, I think, on a level that's beyond just what we see. So I want to ask you a personal question. What did you know about solitary confinement prior to taking these pictures? And how did the act of taking the pictures reshape that knowledge for you?
Taking the pictures changed me, obviously. As Marcia said, that the camera doesn't lie. So I go into some of these places and I don't see signs that say solitary. I see signs that say isolation, timeout room, administrative segregation. So no kid's put in isolation. They're just put in special programming. And the euphemisms go on and on. There are at least 20 different words for solitary that are used. After about 5 years of photographing, I contacted the director of a juvenile center in the Midwest, right outside of Kansas City. And I said, would you let me go into your center and be charged as a kid? And they had a wing that I know was closed. And they fingerprinted me, they mugged me, they booked me. They put me in what they normally do is for assessment and evaluation. They put me in solitary for 24 hours. I knew I was going to get out after 24 hours. There were four buttons. One was for cold water. One was for hot water, which was also cold. One was to flush the toilet, and one was to call the guard. After 24 hours and eating the prison food, the juvenile detention center food, not a prison, I had to use the toilet. So I pressed the button and asked the guard for toilet paper. And he passed four sheets through the trap. It was so dehumanizing, it was unbelievable. I'd set up a camera and put a time lapse in the corner, and I did 24 hours in isolation, not as a token, but to try to experience it. It was pretty brutal for 24 hours for an adult that knows he's getting out. For a kid that's taken out of their home or school and their normal environment and put in here, not for punishment, but for the normal default procedure of assessment and evaluation, it's unimaginable. But to his credit, the director sent me an email December 15th and said, Richard, I want you to know that your actions moved me, and we've eliminated solitary confinement for juveniles in Johnson County, Kansas, and I'm retiring on the 15th. If you chip away at this issue, you can get results. Solitary is the low-hanging fruit. It's a no-brainer. If you see a kid locked in a closet, any adult is going to take the kid out and then try to press charges against the adult that puts the kid in. That's the normal response of a normal human being. The mass incarceration of kids and adults is the bigger issue. But the easy one is isolation, and that's the one we really have to focus on and change that policy very quickly.
Okay. Dr. Goldstein, I want to circle back to you because we talked a little bit earlier about Eastern State Penitentiary and how Philadelphia was really one of the early adopters of solitary confinement, and what Dickens said about the slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain. That's why I love writers, and I am one. Because I think he captured something when he said that. What do we know medically about the brains of juveniles that make them susceptible to being damaged by solitary confinement?
Sure. So, in brief, we know that the adolescent brain is developing very rapidly during this period. And it's really a critical period for development in a variety of ways. One of them is, which I'm sure will come as no surprise to anybody here who has ever dealt with an adolescent or been an adolescent at some point, but adolescents tend to be very driven by emotion, especially in situations that are emotional. So the emotional portions of the brain have developed quicker than the cognitive controls. And so what that means is when an adolescent is in an emotionally arousing setting, they can often be driven into emotional responses rather than having cognitive controls jump in and have reasoning help guide their reactions. And so when you think about solitary confinement, one of the things that happens is the adolescent brain is very focused on short-term positive outcomes for behavior, and they really discount the possibility of long-term negative outcomes, right? So only better things are going to happen to me if I do them now instead of kind of waiting. So there's a lot of risk-taking behavior in adolescence. And what we see in the context of solitary confinement is this is something that's seemingly endless, right? It goes on and on, and you don't know when it's going to end. And even if you do know that time period, whether that's a matter of hours for some kids or days or weeks or months, can feel like it's never going to come to an end. So how do you escape from this? For those kids that are feeling helpless and don't feel connected to anybody, that may be suicide, right? That is a better out. That is a short-term, right? That is a short-term escape from a horrible situation, rather than trying to wait this long-term to try to think about how you can cope with this. So in that context, I think that's very important. The other piece with the adolescent brain is this really is a critical time for development, and it's not one that we can get back. And part of adolescent development is being able to experience normal circumstances, normal social interactions, normal stimulation, and that when you're depriving an adolescent brain of that kind of normal stimulation, when do they get to acquire those skills? When they turn 20, when they turn 25, when they turn 30? They don't then have an opportunity to backtrack to have their brain redevelop. And so you want to make sure that the adolescent brain is developing within children who are functioning in situations you want them to be able to function in long term. So if we're thinking about how do we set kids on a track that we want them to succeed as adults, we want to make their lives as adolescents as normal as possible. And I would think of isolation and solitary confinement as really the absolute opposite of that.
Hmm. So a lot of the studies around this and the research around this, congressionally mandated audit of restricted housing in federal prisons, for example, I'm talking about adults, juveniles, et cetera, published last year, found that roughly 60% of the inmates whose solitary cases were reviewed had serious underdiagnosed or untreated mental illnesses. So people who already are suffering from mental illnesses, when they're placed in solitary, how does it affect them?
So we know that adolescents in facilities tend to have much higher rates of mental health problems in general. They come in with those. They come from environments where they've experienced lots of different types of trauma. And so there's undiagnosed and underdiagnosed and therefore not treated mental health conditions. And so you're starting out already with a real propensity towards some of these serious mental health symptoms. And so when you put young people into these settings, it either can exacerbate existing problems or for some kids it can trigger new problems. Mm. And those are things that don't necessarily, and most of the time, do not just disappear once they end up in a new setting. They can be with these, once they're really triggered or exacerbated, they can continue with them long term. So again, I think just one more piece with that that I think one of the things this highlights is not just the short-term immediate impact of solitary confinement, which is certainly a major risk, especially when we think about suicidality, but also the long-term impacts of it into the future when these kids become older adolescents and adults.
Hmm. Thank you. So we're going to move to Marcia Levick and talk about some of the other things that have happened around juvenile justice within the last year or so. The Supreme Court ruled this year that juveniles sentenced to mandatory life imprisonment must have a chance to argue for their release. Many of the 1,200 to 1,500 affected are concentrated in Pennsylvania and two other states. Philadelphia is gearing up to retry and resentence those juvenile inmates. Are there cases that are going through the courts now that deal with the issue of juvenile solitary confinement, cases that could wind up in the Supreme Court?
So, as when Richard started his remarks, he talked about his experience at Greater for Today, where you had the opportunity to meet with and photograph Joe Ligon, who is actually the longest-serving juvenile lifer in the country. So he has been imprisoned for a crime that he committed as a juvenile, a homicide that he committed when he was 15 years old, for longer than anybody else in the country. And Pennsylvania is dealing with the largest population of juvenile lifers across the country. We have 500 here in the state and 300 who were sentenced out of Philadelphia. I do think that piece of litigation, the Supreme Court's ruling that is requiring that these individuals be resentenced, is a part of this larger conversation that we're having about criminal justice reform and that we're having about solitary confinement. The question of how solitary confinement as an issue of litigation, how it has fared in the courts, has been actually kind of interesting. and in some respects disappointing. We are a country based upon the fact, I think, Solomon, as you started out with your comments, we incarcerate 2.3 million people in this country, more than any other country in the world, substantially more than any of countries that we would consider our peers around the world. We are a country that believes in punishment, that believes in a very strict correctional philosophy, and that believes in treating individuals in a very harsh and in many respects a very inhumane way. The courts have been tolerant of solitary confinement, unfortunately. For adults, we've had some settlements in recent years where we have seen progress being characterized as reducing the period of permissible solitary confinement from being measured in decades to being measured in years. So in Pelican Bay, we can no longer naturally and automatically expect that individuals could be subjected to periods of solitary confinement for 10 years or more. After 2 years, we need to reevaluate their cases. I don't think that anyone in this room would necessarily think that that was progress. For children, we have a different lens through which we look at the work. Obviously, listening to what we've heard this evening, there's nothing productive, there's nothing protective, nothing positive that comes from placing children in solitary confinement. But the courts have not been that quick to respond. We had Juvenile Law Center litigated on behalf of two young men, two 16-year-old boys who were placed in solitary confinement in the New Jersey juvenile justice system. They had been placed in solitary in a cell exactly the size of the cell upstairs, one of them for 7 months, without interruption and with absolutely nothing available to him in terms of any kind of audible, visual, human stimulation whatsoever. We settled that case for monetary compensation for that young man. New Jersey has changed its permissible limits on solitary confinement. It now measures those limits in days rather than weeks or months. But of course, what President Obama said in his executive order, the standard that we think must be the one that guides our work going forward, is really no solitary confinement at all, except in the context of thinking of it as a cool down period, a timeout, where you may separate someone from population for an hour or 2 hours, at most 3 hours, allow whatever the agitating factor is that is creating risk of harm in the facility, that is jeopardizing potential safety in the facility. And as soon as that is removed, as soon as that is suppressed, you return that individual to the general population. We have not seen this case go before the U.S. Supreme Court yet. Justice Kennedy, in an opinion 2 years ago, actually invited the bar to bring this issue before the U.S. Supreme Court, because I think he is someone who recognizes he has an interest in international law. I suspect he is aware that the international human rights community condemns the use of solitary confinement and very specifically condemns it with respect to children and would characterize it as torture. So I think that it is an issue where we're seeing some progress in state legislatures, obviously some progress at the federal level, but I would expect that we will see opportunities for more litigation going forward.
Yeah, and that was what I was jotting down, great minds think alike. The executive branch has acted on juvenile justice through this executive order from the president. The judicial branch has acted with the Supreme Court ruling on these life sentences. What's up with the legislative branch?
Legislatures, that's a great question. I don't know if there are any prosecutors in the room, forgive me. You know, but in our legislatures across the country, it's not limited to Pennsylvania, district attorneys carry an enormous amount of weight and influence. And so long as they carry that influence, it is difficult to move legislation that really aims at radically changing. And I think we're talking about radical transformation here. We're not looking for incremental change when we are trying to upend what are extraordinarily inhumane practices, as you have heard someone bear witness to this evening. I think the political will is not there in the ways that we need it. For all of the bipartisan effort that has been driven and directed toward reducing rates of incarceration. We need to be able to focus that energy and that interest on really looking inside the prisons and looking at how we're treating people.
All right. Johnny Perez, the Obama administration had this issue on its radar screen in the summer of 2015. They asked the Justice Department to review the policy before issuing the order to stop juvenile solitary confinement in federal prisons. What would you, as someone who's experienced this, say to the next administration to convince them to make the elimination of juvenile solitary confinement a priority?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think about a few different things, which I jotted down. The first thing that comes to mind is incrementalism, where we change this small piece of the puzzle, but the entire picture still remains the same. You know, like she mentioned earlier, you know, only the legislation really only affected, as of the turn of the year, 20-something kids, close to 30 kids.
26.
You know, 26, thank you. And, you know, of course, on the surface, it looks great. And, of course, we definitely want to ban it on the federal level. And, of course, he's limited by what he can do, you know. But there's still kids being placed in solitary, still people being placed in solitary. Just the other day, I read an article about this young kid in Massachusetts, 15 years old, gets sent to the box for 50 days for throwing spitballs. Last time I checked, 15-year-olds, that's what they do. They throw, I mean, I know some adults that throw spitballs, but that's what they do. So we've gotten to a point in our country where we are actually punishing kids for being kids, right? So I would definitely warn against, I'll definitely warn against that. And one of the ways to kind of combat that is, which might be a little risque in this space, but this dichotomy between adults and juveniles, right? When we say adults, juveniles should not be in solitary, inadvertently we're saying that adults belong there. And, you know, I always think about, you know, Obama mentioned, he said, you know, kids have the capacity to change, you know. And last time I also checked, you know, so do adults, you know. I think that part of the problem is having a clear definition about exactly what solitary is. Right, and we've heard panelists say before we have different names, right? Administrative segregation, involuntary PC, protective custody, you know, special housing units. All of these different names for like the same thing. So we ban solitary, but we still keep people in IPC, or we keep people in protective custody, we keep people key blocked, or we put them in solitary when we take them from one facility to another. You know, and then in the jail system, it's completely different because you haven't been convicted. You're just a detainee. So having a clear-cut definition on solitary that includes all people that are in solitary and solitary-like conditions can definitely move the needle forward and move this conversation forward. Lastly, I want to add that, you know, between policy and practice, there's this space, right? And the reason that there's this huge space is because we have the people in this nation are writing policies about people who they have never come in contact with, will never come in contact with, and probably don't even care about coming in contact with them, right? So it makes sense if you're going to create a way to make the best tomatoes in the world, you want to invite the farmers in, right? So I always mention that you want to include the voices of the people that are directly affected when you designing these policies, when you're involved, when you're creating these legislations in order to make the policy the most effective policy possible. I'll leave it there for now.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to thank our panelists for this portion. Give them a hand, please. And now it is your opportunity to pose your questions, and I believe the questions are being submitted to me now. Okay. So I will pose this question, and we'll treat this like a political debate and just let you talk over each other. No, I'm kidding. So the first question is, what can I do to help end solitary if I'm a regular citizen with no involvement in juvenile justice? And I'll give that one first to Marcia.
I was hoping you would give it to Johnny, but
I'll take it.
I think it's, I welcome the question, and I appreciate someone wanting to know what you can do. You know, we each have a role to play, and how we choose to engage may depend either on what our professional opportunities are or what our community engagement opportunities are. Certainly, as you've heard this evening, there are ways to change solitary confinement through our various branches of government, through the judicial branch, the legislative branch, and the executive branch. We live in a state that is a very Republican state. We have two, both of our houses of our General Assembly are dominated by Republicans. However, there is also a bipartisan movement across the country that has frankly been led by a conservative right on crime movement that has been promoting fairly progressive, and I say that with all seriousness, criminal justice reform policies. And so I think one of the ways to think about how you can get engaged in a very basic way is really thinking about how you utilize your political power and how you utilize your opportunity to cast a vote at the ballot box, because the legislature has an enormous amount of authority to change what happens in our institutions and in our facilities. And this is one, I actually agree with Richard. It should be low-hanging fruit, and I'd like to think it is low-hanging fruit. Who thinks it's a good idea to lock kids in a closet? And if we can communicate that message, then if we can't win in the courts, then maybe we can win in our legislatures.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to move on to the next question. How do you see the roles of research and data versus impacted youth and family complementing each other or working together? And I will give that one to Dr. Goldstein.
Sure. So, I mean, I think research tells us a lot about what's the impact of these kinds of situations and experiences on young people. And that information can go a long way, especially towards legal arguments. I mean, you got JLC uses social science research quite a lot in a lot of your arguments. But it doesn't have a face to it. So as you talked about the public power, really, in thinking about this, yes, it's helpful to know the negative traumatic impacts of solitary confinement on individuals. It's great to know that it deprives the adolescent brain of important stimulation for development, but it doesn't put a human face on it. The stories that you hear from individuals who go through this or their families who are suffering along with them really is invaluable in making it relatable and making you imagine what it's like to take your child or your sibling and put them in a closet and lock the door for a really long time. And those two things, I think, are important together to move these efforts forward.
Hmm. Someone asked the question, why is no one talking about race? So there it is. The question is out there. Why is no one talking about race? I talk about race every day for 3 hours in the beginning of the day, and then I write about race twice a week, once in Newsweek and once in Newsworks for WHYY, and then I might do a commentary about race based on what I wrote about race in Newsworks. And then I write about race in the Daily News on Wednesday. So I was hoping to get a little bit of a break. But, I mean, in all seriousness, this stuff begins before kids even make it into juvenile facilities. Black kids are more likely to be suspended than white kids when they are in preschool. And if a kid is suspended twice, they're more likely to drop out. And if they drop out, they're more likely to go to jail. And if they go to jail, they're more likely to go back to jail. And so race permeates this before the kids even get into these juvenile facilities. So I'll ask Richard about that first, and then Johnny.
I don't know if I'm the best person, but my camera speaks to that issue.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell you that probably 88% of the kids don't belong in there at all. Maybe 12% of the kids are kids you should be afraid of and really need treatment and really need isolation from society to some extent. When I look at these kids, they're all black. Vinny Schiraldi, who's now up at the Kennedy School, was in charge of the Washington, D.C. system. He said he was there for 3 years. He never saw a white face. So when you look at these kids, they're all kids of color. And they're all kids that have no voice, that in a very minuscule way I'm able to give a voice, but from families with no resources and communities without any power. So when you take a look at the zip code of Kensington and know that the kids from that zip code are much more likely to go to detention and prison rather than college, it's not the kids' fault, it's society's fault. How do you change that? I have to defer to other people more knowledgeable than I am.
Johnny.
Yeah, just a few things. So in addition to the 60 days, I did a total of 3 years in solitary. 60 of those days were as an adolescent. I served a total of 13 years in prison for a robbery that I committed when I was 21 years old. And throughout my travels, I did see a huge disproportionate imbalance in the racism, whether it's in the entire prison population, but specifically, you know, who was going to the box, what they were going for, and for how long they were going for. I can tell you, you know, from firsthand experience, that racism is very rampant behind, on the other side of that barbed wire fence. You know, I've been called, you know, the N-word to my face a bunch of times, you know. And I can also tell you that, you know, specifically for kids, I think that the problem stems that we see one group of people, specifically, you know, people probably of that are not of color, as more deserving of whether compassion of, you know, preserving their dignity and humanity than young kids of color, you know, and that reflects itself in our policies and definitely reflects itself inside who's inside that cell and what it is that they're doing.
Okay. Dr. Goldstein, I want to ask you this question, which came from our audience. Should we be treating children together with their parents? Would that improve results by allowing kids to work on family issues? And what else works?
Sure. And there's quite a bit of research showing that really comprehensive family treatment that's involving parents, sometimes it's grandparents, sometimes it's siblings, aunts, uncles, whoever's important in this child's life is critical. And this comes back, again, to what we were talking about before, that I think this is important no matter what the age is. People don't exist on an island. They're part of larger systems. They have social support, hopefully. But regardless, they're going to be interacting with people. And that's true for anyone, but for kids in particular, their lives are so dependent and intertwined with their parents or guardians or whoever they're living with, whoever is their social support, that treating them by themselves, again, is this, it's not the way you want them to exist, right? If you're going to provide a treatment to improve their functioning, part of that functioning is their interactions with other people. And many times these are really negative interactions. And so how do you work together to improve them? And just removing them from their homes and their communities and putting them into a facility where they're locked away. And even if they learn skills in that setting and they learn information and they learn how to improve their interactions with others, very, very, very difficult to transfer that knowledge and experience and skills back home or back to school or back to their communities. That's something, transfer of knowledge and skills is something that's hard for all of us to do, but when you think about the long histories of negative interactions many of these kids and families have had, it's critically important to provide treatment together, not separately. And for those where they've had really supportive interactions, it's also important to have that able to continue when they're in settings that are difficult.
So another question from our audience, and we'll stick with you, Dr. Goldstein. What about those juveniles who are a danger to themselves or others?
Clearly, there's, you know, as you just talked about, there are a small number. It's not most of these kids who are in facilities, but some of them are presenting dangers for periods of time, and those need to be dealt with. Does isolation help with that? Over the long term, no. Most kids, we actually know it increases anger, it increases future aggression, in addition to mental health problems. So how can you proactively deal with that? And it's really about using treatments or approaches that we know work, trying to use supportive settings that certainly are still providing protective mechanisms but are not denying them access to treatment, access to stimulation, access to engagement in positive activities, which can really be quite helpful in improving their general functioning.
So do children in solitary receive education, A, And B, do they have the right to receive education? And I'm going to ask that in two halves, the first half to Johnny and then the second half to Marcia.
Yeah, in my experience, education looks like the teacher walks by your cell once a week and gives you a handout and says, fill it out, I'll be back next week to fill it out. Of course, on a policy, on a paper, it says, oh, they received this, that, and a third. But in practice, that's the way that it looks like. I remember my pen had enough ink to write exactly 2.5 pages of paper. So when we talk about, okay, you know, is there education, maybe on the surface or maybe on paper, it looks like it. But in practice, it really doesn't even work that way. If I have a question, you know, learning is an interactive process. You know, you learn something, you ask questions, you challenge. You know, and solitary doesn't allow for that. And even the space itself, you know, I mean, you're talking to someone through bulletproof glass and you're screaming and have to put your ear to the door every time they speak, that in itself is not conducive to learning. I've seen group therapy sessions where the person is handcuffed talking to the psychiatrist, you know. I ask myself, you know, how is it that on one hand we can say that we value education, things like dignity and human worth, but on the other hand, treat people so inhumanely and as if they're worthless? When I was in a box as a kid, you know, not only did I not use the handouts, I used the back of the handouts to write whatever else I wanted to, but I also didn't receive any anger management while I was there, any drug treatment while I was there. Mind you, I was there for a fight, so you would think anger management would be there. You know, drug treatment while I was there. You know, the psychiatrist comes by once a week, and she literally used to ask me, do you feel like killing yourself? You know, which I'm not a psychiatrist, but I don't think that's the best way to ask that question. You know, and you know, is it deserving? Of course that, you know, we all have a fundamental human right to be educated. You know, it's unfortunate that our laws don't reflect that in a lot of different spaces.
Mm-hmm. Do they have the right legally, Marcia?
Yeah. So this is education. This is another example where I think the rights don't match the practice. Children in this country, in a state like Pennsylvania, every state has a compulsory school age below which children are required to go to school. And I actually believe, as we've talked about low-hanging fruit, that in my view, this is the lowest hanging fruit, that children who are in facilities who are of compulsory school age absolutely have a right to education. We set up these bizarre, both physical and virtual and imaginary walls between kids and what's on the other side of that cell that we imagine somehow erects a barrier to delivering education. But if you think about it, what is it about being on the other side of that door that prevents you from receiving educational materials, that prevents someone from interacting with you in the cell, not on the other side of the cell, that prevents you from even engaging with the general population in those opportunities? A substantial number of children in the correctional system, in the juvenile justice system, have special education needs. We have federal law that requires that children with special education needs have a right to an individualized education program up through their 21st birthday, and that is a right that is not in any way limited by their incarceration. That's what federal law requires. So in this respect, I would say that both state and federal law provides rights. Institutions interfere with the delivery of those services and with the implementation of those rights, in a sense, because they can, because they get away with it. Nobody came and worried about what you weren't receiving when you were at Rikers. But as I said, as a lawyer, to me, these are cases that we can win because those rights are pretty explicit.
All right. So we're going to end pretty soon, but I do want to ask these couple questions to Richard Ross. I think they're important. How did you gain access to so many facilities where children were being held in solitary? Was there pushback from facility administrators? And then this one, did you enter into the profession of photography knowing that you wanted to bear witness and display social injustices?
The first question of how I got in?
How'd you get into those facilities? Was there pushback from the administrators?
The pushback from the administrators was ridiculous. Mm-hmm. I grew up in New York. I never knew how to take no for an answer. And when you realize that lives are at stake, it just becomes that more compelling. The only place, as I told Johnny, that there's also effort versus reward, the only place that I think I almost have to give up on is Rikers. Those sons of bitches won't let me in for anything. And everything about this world is very counterintuitive. You think New York is going to be liberal and open and transparent? Exactly the reverse. I'm much more welcome in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, than I am in New York City. And what was your second question?
The second question is, did you enter the field of photography knowing that you wanted to bear witness and expose social injustices?
There was a great article in the New York Times Magazine this past week by Chuck Close, who said that you shouldn't be afraid of your later years as an artist, because that's when you could take all the chances. And somebody asked me, how did I begin this about 10 years ago? And it was really when the first kid in the El Paso Juvenile Detention Center started talking to me when I was doing architectural work on a different project. And the question really isn't how do you start, but when you realize you're the conduit for these very fragile voices, how do you stop? So I'm not sure how I got involved in this. I'm almost 70 years old, and this work is literally punishing, emotionally, physically. I haven't sold a photograph in about 10 years. And it's great. It's the most... my wife, who's in the audience, is wonderful, and it's hard for me to explain to her how I'm in absolute bliss when I'm sitting on the floor of a cell with my shoes off and listening to a 12 or 13-year-old kid share their story with me. It's nirvana. How I can do this is perfect. I never want to stop.
Okay. So I want to ask this question to Johnny. Someone posed the question, how do we elevate voices like yours? And how do we shift the narrative to prioritizing treatment and rehabilitation and away from punishment and criminalization?
That's a very good question. I think part of the problem is that we don't see people as people, you know? And it's reflective in our language, right? We say, you know, when you go inside of a jail, you say, how many heads do you have? How many bodies do you have? We use words like criminal, inmate, sex offender, murderer, right? These are all dehumanizing language, right? So there's things that I can do to a criminal that I can't do to a son. There's things that I can do to an inmate that I can't do to a father, right? So the first thing that you can definitely do is describe people as people. People say, well, you don't like to be called inmate. Well, just call me what I am, a person. Because now when we start to humanize people and we start to see people as people, it's easier to treat them as such. So I think that's part of the big issue. As far as augmenting the voices, you do that by being inclusive, by involving people. Don't speak for me, speak with me, you know? And I can't tell you the number of different spaces where people are writing about us but not talking with us. And we're like, oh, that's not accurate. You know, and you avoid that by you know, being inclusive. Hey, what do you think about this? Would you like to be part of this? You know, contrary to popular belief, you know, the people, and to quote a good friend of mine, Glenn Martin out of New York, he says, you know, the people closest to the problem are also closest to the solution. You know, and when we think about journalism and things like that, it's to come as close as possible to the truth. This is how you can sit inside of a cell and talk to a kid directly. You know, your ear is right next to the truth. You know, and then, you know, having integrity and not only, you know, sharing that information with people, but also not just the easy crowd. Like, this is an easy crowd. People kind of get it. But go into the fire where people say, you know what, I like solitary. We need solitary, and then make the argument, because those are the spaces where our voices are needed the most, and therein lies exactly how we can move this needle forward. The conversation is going to get a whole lot more difficult before it gets easier, and we need to go into spaces, you know, where, you know, the Donald Trumps of the world, and say, you know, this is we don't need this, and here's a person whose, you know, whose personal experience or whatever through their story, and through this story, of course, they get humanized, you know, to hear exactly the horrors of it, you know, and then exactly how can we address it. There's a legislator right now somewhere saying that you want solitary here. Even if you didn't say it out your mouth, because you said it with your tax dollars. You said it by not voting or voting, either or. You know, so definitely, you know, to echo what was said earlier, exercise your right as an American citizen and say, I refuse to support this. You know, and additionally, you know, for correctional staff, this is a problem of, oh, if we don't have solitary, then what are we going to do with the kids, you know? And I get it. some kids just don't play well in the sandbox with others. You know, I was definitely one of them. And I can tell you that there, you know, I would argue that there, you know, you can separate a person from the general population and not isolate them. I would also argue that there's never a time in which you have to treat someone inhumanely in order to hold them accountable. You can hold them accountable, but just not necessarily treat them inhumanely in the course of holding them accountable.
Okay. All right. All right.
So this will be the last question, because I think it's a necessary question, because I really want to end there. But this is a necessary question. What are the next steps, Marcia, for the Juvenile Law Center in addressing this issue of juvenile solitary confinement?
So Juvenile Law Center is actually participating and working with colleagues around the country as part of a campaign effort to address and end solitary confinement. You saw in the video a Stop Solitary, there's a hashtag and a campaign and a website that is aimed at